listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the late 1960s, following the massive upsurge of students and workers in France in 1968 that brought the country to a halt, a small group of intellectuals looked to the Chinese Cultural Revolution and the politics of everyday life, which they regarded as a new dynamic model for the ossified left. The turn towards Maoist politics in the late 1960s and 70s may seem like an obscure, and at times embarrassing, chapter in French intellectual life. Yet in fact, it had profound consequences for the left, and even the right, in that country and beyond, playing a central role in launching the gay and women's liberation movements, and deeply shaping the ideas of leading thinkers like Jean-Paul Sartre and Michel Foucault. My guest today has written a fascinating book about the influence and legacy of French Maoism. Richard Wolin is the author of The Wind from the East, May 68, French Intellectuals and the Chinese Cultural Revolution, published by Princeton University Press. He's a professor of history at the CUNY Graduate Center. Richard, it's a pleasure to have you with us. And I wonder if I could start by asking you to paint a picture of the context in which the tumult of 1968 and then Maoism emerged. How was France transformed in the post-World War II period when it was transformed more by, not so much by the left, but in fact by the right?
Right. It's hard to imagine in retrospect how tumultuous the 50s were in France. It was kind of the decade of the Cold War and political stalemate here in the United States. In France, of course, they were involved up to their necks, if that's the right metaphor to use, in decolonization with the outbreak of the war in Algeria, the Algerian War of Independence in 54. And that same year was the year of the devastating French defeat in Indochina, formerly French Indochina, which we know as Vietnam, at Dien Bien Phu. And this was a real blow to the French national ego. The whole wave of decolonization following the traumas of defeat at the hands of the Nazis in 1940, as well as the traumas of the occupation by German troops. So France had suffered a number of political setbacks. Algeria was part of metropolitan France. There were a million Europeans living there, and this was an incredibly tumultuous time for French youth to grow up. And many of the many of the future 68ers experienced these events as youths, and it marked them very deeply. In a nutshell, France had gone from the victim of right-wing authoritarianism in the form of Nazism to being itself an oppressor, a nation of torturers in Algeria, which is now well documented. And this alienated many post-war youth from French political culture. And finally, De Gaulle came to power in 58 and initiated the Fifth Republic, but this was basically a constitutional coup d'etat. So de Gaulle's quote-unquote legitimacy was highly questionable. And by 68, he'd been in office for 10 years and had no real serious competitors. There was little possibility of regime change at that time, and French youth presumed that it was living under a dictatorship.
And yet at the same time, although there was all of this turmoil that was happening in Algeria, and some of it was brought home to France, at the same time, French society went through great changes in the post-war period, socially, economically, and so on, which for many people seemed to reinforce a sense of complacency and the ebbing of the kind of radical elan that might have been associated with the resistance and certainly with French history. What happened socially during that time?
Well, that's a really good question, because one of the key causes of May 68 in France, where one has 10 million people, or 20% of the population, almost 20%, participating in a general strike, which is almost an unprecedented development, certainly in the post-war period or in the advanced industrial society. One of the key problems was this, as you described it, this disjunction between the political authoritarianism. De Gaulle himself had been born in the 19th century. He was a living atavism in many ways, but the progressive nature of many social developments, progressive insofar as some French sociologists and social thinkers joke that France only left the Middle Ages after World War II because this is the point where it became, where it was no longer a predominantly rural society, a peasant society, if you will, and really went the modern route, the hyper-modern route of industrialization, urbanization, etc., and the economy was booming, as it was in many cases in the West. They call this period from 45 to 75 les trente glorieuses, the 30 glorious years, referring to this age of unprecedented affluence. So you have these social developments that are accelerating at a furious pace on the one hand, and then you have this political atavism of a benign dictatorship led by Charles de Gaulle and his party. So this was a road to disaster or future confrontation that was certainly building up.
And yet at the same time, the organizations and institutions of the left, which had been appealing in the past, seem to have lost their luster. Although, of course, the French Communist Party was very large in France, this new generation did not look to the French Communist Party in the way that preceding generations had. Can you describe their attitude towards those institutions of the left, like the French Communist Party, and more broadly, the Soviet Union and the Soviet model?
Yes. After the resistance in World War II, which was the kind of sole reference point for French heroism in what is sometimes called the dark years of 1940 to 1944, the years of occupation, the Communist Party really led the resistance. After the Hitler-Stalin Pact, they had actually cooperated with the Nazis until the Nazi invasion of Soviet Union in 1941. No one talks about those two transitional years, but the French Communist Party had emerged from World War II with a considerable amount of prestige. It was known as the Parti des Fusilés, or the ones who were shot to death by the opponents. They took many risks. But this prestige began hemorrhaging very quickly among students, intellectuals, and the broader French public, that is, almost everyone aside from workers, after the Warsaw Pact invasion of Hungary in November 1956. It was very difficult for the French Communist Party to recruit prestigious intellectuals. Even Sartre, who'd been a fellow traveler for a number of years, as of the early 50s, began to sour on the French Communist Party. After 56, he wrote a book called The Ghost of Stalin. Although he maintained his ties to the left and still had hopes for a party-based revolution. But there's another generational aspect or disjunction that goes back to our last question or conversation, which has to do with this is the generation of French youth. There's a very popular TV show that caters to French youth. The songs from the British invasion are playing in radios around the world. The French Communist Party is a party of septuagenarians. It's very staid. It's very unreceptive to youth culture. It is really not tuned into the times. And this was, kind of disjunction between the up-and-coming generation and the previous generation. The prestige of the resistance, but at this point, really couldn't carry the French Communist Party through this new era. There were so many new problems and issues having to do with, the consumer society, youth culture, questions of you know, the sexual revolution, et cetera, that the French Communist Party was just distinctly behind the times.
And yet, the degree to which the French Communist Party and the Soviet Union represented the fusty old bureaucratized ways of the past, after the Sino-Soviet split in the early 60s, China came to represent something different, something related to youthfulness and to the reinvigoration of the revolutionary impulse. Can you describe the appeal of China starting in the 60s and what it represented for people in faraway places like France?
Right. That's so important because in terms of the political mentality of the times, one has this important manifesto in 1960 by Franz Fanon from Martinique. Jean-Paul Sartre wrote the preface to it, The Wretched of the Earth, translated into about 40 languages, probably a few languages into which it wasn't translated. And, of course, it was an appeal for violence against colonial nations had an immense impact, but this was all part of the mentality of third worldism. Castro's revolution, successful revolution in Cuba, overthrowing Batista in the late 50s, in addition to events in elsewhere in South America, etc., all created the attractions of third worldism, which only reinforced the sense that the European bureaucratic socialist or communist states of Eastern Europe under the thumb of the Soviet Union were an outmoded phenomenon and not a viable revolutionary model. Then in 66, Mao launches the what he called the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, and the protagonists of the Cultural Revolution were students, were Red Guards with red armbands. Mao even early on dismissed, suspended university and high school classes so that the Red Guards could go throughout the countryside and find so-called bourgeois roaders and recidivist party members and re-educate them. Part of it was a power grab on Mao's part, or a re-grab on Mao's part, because he'd suffered a considerable loss of esteem after the Great Leap Forward, which was a disaster in the realm of the reorganization of Chinese agriculture. And he had lost the presidency of the Chinese Communist Party. So this was an attempt for him both to regain power, but also to re-enliven the Chinese Communist Revolution and prevent it from a fate of bureaucratic stagnation as the Soviet Union had been accused of. And this played, you know, there are these now famous films in retrospect. They were even fairly well known at the time by Jean-Luc Godard. France is a literary culture. It's a culture that is in love with cinema. And in 67, Godard comes out with one of several films in a pro-Chinese vein, La Chinoise, that proceeded to fascinate French youth and helped to make events in China part of the agenda of the day and a potential political alternative, especially in light of the fact that the other left-wing potentialities and possibilities seem to have tanked. At the time, the Socialist Party was in a complete state of disarray, and as I mentioned a few minutes ago, there seemed to be no viable parliamentary alternatives to Gaullism. So, and of course, just one last point in this matter, as I mentioned in the book, France is really the home of the and the seedbed of the modern revolutionary tradition, with 1789, then following that, the proclamation of the Republic in August 1792. There's a glorious history of revolutionism in French cultural life, and it was very easy for the French to piggyback, as it were, on these other revolutionary events. There was a line of continuity, and I mentioned earlier the political difficulties that post-war France had succumbed to. This was a way of revivifying French political life, French political traditions, injecting new blood, one last gasp of an attempt at resuscitating the logic of revolution. And it's an almost natural fit between the revolutionary tide of third worldism in Cuba, China, South America, and elsewhere, and the French gave birth to it. So there was kind of a natural fit.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with intellectual historian Richard Wolin, who's the author of The Wind from the East. So another factor which helped shape the ideas of the time that really came to the fore in 1968 is the ideas of the council communists, the situationists, groups like socialism or barbarism. What were the ideas of these very small groups, which then ended up having a great influence on the student protesters in May of 68?
Yes, that's a very important question. And it's, in retrospect, it's remarkable that the socialism or barbarism group, which was founded by Claude Lefort and Cornelius Castiadis, at its peak, probably had something like 80, 90 members. The situationist group, of course, was much smaller, in part due to the constant excommunications of members of its leader, Guy Debord. And it is a remarkable fact that these small groups who were dismissed by the French Communist Party as groupuscules, little groups, could have such a pronounced intellectual influence on the student activists in the 60s and the protagonists of May 68. Part of the reason has to do with French political culture, facts of French political culture, the centralization of French political and intellectual life in Paris, the old revolutionary motto that whoever controls Paris controls the rest of France. This is a important explanation for the facilities which France seems to slip into a revolutionary mode. And of course, Paris also being the heart of French student life and intellectual life, small publications such as the Situationist International Journal, Socialism or Barbarism, were very widely read, mimeographed, discussed, and became something of a breviary for many of the leading activists in 68. This is readily admitted by Daniel Cohn-Bendit, who was, of course, the student leader in May 68, although he was an anarchist, derived many of his ideas from some of these groups. But in addition to the fascination with council communism, workers' democracy, and self-organization of society, all these groups had very insightful and prescient critiques of the authoritarian nature of the Soviet Union and aspects of the Leninist tradition as well. And this played an important role in informing the students or cluing them in not to trust the French Communist Party if they were so tempted, and to concern themselves with questions of self-organization, workers' democracy, and what the French call autogestion, or self-management. And this might seem a marginal idea even at the time, even it was very fashionable at the time, but these kinds of ideas were the germ cell of what one in France calls the second left under, with the Socialist Party, the Reformed Socialist Party in 1971 under François Mitterrand, and the self-management wing of the French Socialist Party. So these ideas really didn't get very far ultimately, but bespoke a sensitivity to the excesses of traditional French étatisme or statism, bureaucracy, all problems that were addressed and thematized in these small journals of the ultra-left.
So what then led to the pretty much unexpected upsurge that took place in May of 1968 in France.
We've talked for a few minutes about the repressive nature of French conditions and the effervescence of youth culture and third worldism. This was an era where images played a very important role. This is the first television generation, a generation that could experience events halfway around the world, especially in Vietnam. Atrocities perpetrated in Southeast Asia were beamed later in the day on the evening news, and it was impossible to ignore them. This happened world over, and this is an important explanation for the fact that 68 was something of a miraculous year, since revolutionary upsurges broke out in 6, 7, 8, 9 major cities throughout the world. Paris was part of this logic, but exceptional insofar as not only were students involved, but one had, shortly after the student uprising in early May, a general strike where millions of workers joined in. The pretext of the uprising in May was quite small. In fact, there were a number, the movement really started in a suburban university of Nanterre, a god-awful, ugly university made of concrete. Actually, I taught there a few years ago, so perhaps I should be more generous. But it was way out in the suburbs. It was impossible to get to Paris. The last bus from Paris back to Nanterre, there was no metro system out there at the time, left at 8 at night or so. And there was no library yet. This is where Daniel Cohn-Bendit was active, and where he was a student. And a number of the students were arrested on the basis of protests related to attacks on an American Express office in central Paris. And this really was the catalyst that spurred, and then the University of Nanterre was closed down by the dean. And this was, in retrospect, a tremendous blunder on the part of the forces of order, because then the students moved from the suburbs to the campus of the Sorbonne in early May, and then it snowballed in the heart of Paris. And it was really, the situation was a tinderbox where the smallest spark really could give rise. There were precipitating events in earlier years having to do with student overcrowded universities, unresponsive professors, curricula that were incredibly outmoded, 19th century oriented, very traditional. So again, you have this leitmotif of the disjunction between, the 60s, this relatively hip, ultra-modern era, and France, the French elite, and the French classe politique, or political class, trying to remain traditional and trying to remain French in an old-fashioned way. So, here's another disjunction that's suggests cause for great sparks and conflict.
So once these protests started, first the French Communist Party was quite scornful toward the students and then belatedly got on board. What was the component to all of this on the labor front, and how did it ultimately play out?
It's really fascinating because despite the French Communist Party's significant electoral impact and influence, I mean, this is a party that was actually the largest vote getter in the first post-war World War II elections in 1944, which is kind of hard to believe in retrospect, but this was really a kind of year zero in French political life, the onset of the Fourth Republic. But also in the 60s, despite the Communist Party's influence, French workers were abysmally paid and had many, many grievances. It was in many respects, in terms of employee or worker relations, extremely backward and non-progressive. And it's important to recognize that the strikes on the part of the workers in solidarity with the students after the first week of protests. This is circa May 12th, 1968, were wildcat strikes against the wishes on the part of the French Communist Party, because, of course, the French Communist Party, A, feared a movement they couldn't control, and B, they were suspicious of these ultra-left currents, the Trotskyists, the anarchists, to a lesser extent, some of the group of schools I mentioned, who were, at the head of the student movement. Of course, the French Communist Party, being a very orthodox worker party, dismissed the student revolt and student problems. They called them, belittled them as, in French, as fils à papa, or a bunch of daddy's boys. This couldn't be serious in terms of a logic of, revolutionary upsurge. But, of course, the important lesson here is that the logic of revolution and protest and, grassroots politics had changed tremendously before May 68 and after May 68. A very new ethos of political participation had taken hold against traditional French authoritarianism. And here, too, the Communist Party found it very difficult to catch up. So in many ways, the workers were well in advance of what the party was willing to provide them with. And, of course, the students, in retrospect, felt that the Communist Party eventually sold out the revolutionary upsurge of May 68 as a result of a new wage accord that was reached at the end of May, called the Grenelle Accords, that for the most part brought many workers off the streets back into the factories, although wildcat strikes remained and there were several future incidents of factory occupations and worker self-management. But this was another testament, if the students needed one or French society needed one, to what they called in the language of the times the counter-revolutionary nature of the French Communist Party, which was a party that was well ensconced in the parliamentary, it was a party of order. It was well ensconced in French parliamentary life and political life. They had much more to lose by a general strike than they had to gain.
My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're looking at the fascinating and complex history of Maoism in France following the 1968 revolt in May. And my guest is Richard Wolin. He's the author of a book precisely about those times. It's called The Wind from the East, May 68, French Intellectuals and the Chinese Cultural Revolution, published by Princeton University Press. He teaches history at the CUNY Graduate Center, and his books include The Seduction of Unreason, The Intellectual Romance with Fascism from Nietzsche to Postmodernism. He writes for, amongst other publications, The Nation. You were discussing all of the events that led to this explosion in May of 1968. There was a group of young Maoists who were clustered around the French philosopher Louis Althusser, who essentially missed the boat on 68. They were radicals themselves, but underestimated what was happening in May. They are, of course, the kind of the origin point for the Maoist movements that developed in France, the subject of your book. But before we get into what they did during 68, perhaps you could tell us who were these people and what was the influence of Althusser on them, given that he was a member of the French Communist Party, a stalwart member who never left, and yet someone also attracted to Maoism.
Yes, this is a fascinating story because, of course, the students at the École Normale Supérieure, which is the pinnacle of French student life, one is, it's a very highly competitive exam. So it's really, as I described in the book, la crème de la crème. They're given fellowships for 5 years, and the students who are Maoists often joke that, well, now we have a fellowship for 5 years to create a revolution. This is how they spent their time. Althusser was sitting on the fence a bit because he was a longstanding member of the French Communist Party, and firmly believed that there was no road to socialism or communism apart from the supervision and the good graces of the Communist Party. So on the one hand, his students, in keeping with the political winds of the time, were highly radicalized and influenced by Third Worldism. And as you correctly pointed out a while ago, this is the era following the bitter Sino-Soviet rift in the early 60s. Incredible animosity between these two nations. Students tried to infiltrate the youth organization of the French Communist Party and pulled them further to the left towards China in 66. When this didn't work, they set out to found their own breakaway organization, a Marxist-Leninist Communist Youth Association. It was a very small group. Althusser occasionally contributed to their journal, which was called the Cahiers Marxist-Leninistes, Marxist-Leninist Notebooks, although he wouldn't sign his articles for fear of crossing the party. It was a very intense milieu, tumultuous milieu, at the same time noted for its incredible dogmatism. There's a very interesting institutional dynamic at work here, where the elitism of the École Normale students prevented them from mixing with the other students at the other Parisian universities. They considered themselves, as I say in the book, les purs et les durs, the real hardcore, dedicated Maoist revolutionaries. And the irony here is, of course, 90% of them were of haute bourgeois origin. But this is a really important trope or insight into the, you know, sociology of political sociology of French youth culture of the day, because for French writers and political actors, the idea of bourgeois self-hatred is very prominent. The vulgarity of the bourgeois, the lack of refinement, the prosaicism of the bourgeois' concerns is a constant theme in French cultural life. So the part of what was going on here, I think in retrospect, was a large dose of bourgeois self-hatred in these students identifying so profoundly with the most radical political ideas they could find out there, Third Worldism and Maoism, in order to divest themselves of their own past. Many of them went to work in factories in order to get closer to workers. And there are some interesting autobiographies written in retrospect. But it's a very interesting phenomenon that this relatively small group of Maoists really at the École Normale, only 80 or 90 or so, eventually ended up playing such an important, pivotal role in the post-68 years.
So the Maoist students managed to miss the significance of May and then, I guess, scrambled to try and catch up. But their moment was, as you write in The Wind from the East, somewhat accidental. Tell us what happened with the French state that gave them such a boost.
Well, yes, as I say, the Maoists at the École Normale were a very small group. They were, by the same token, a very active group, a very activist group, highly visible, and they achieved some notoriety in the post-68 years when the political enthusiasm of May had ebbed significantly. They were the ones known for keeping the spirit of May alive in various respects. Already, though, 2 years after May 68, now we're in the spring of 1970, there was a new move toward cultural politics, and one has the onset of French feminism, Mouvement Libération des Femmes, French women's liberation movement, the onset of homosexual liberation, etc. Well, this actually comes a year later in 1971 with Guy Hockengem's acknowledgement, confession, Nouvel Observateur, of his homosexuality, which really is the kind of catalyzes French homosexual liberation, etc. Similar movements arise in the provinces. So there's a transition away from the dogmatism of a Marx, kind of a hardcore Marxist-Leninist party-oriented philosophy to what I call in the book the critique of everyday life and the attempt to address issues of human interrelationships, etc., in a much more pluralistic vein. Many of these issues have been addressed in some of the left-wing journals we talked about a few minutes ago, such as Socialism or Barbarism or the Situationist International Journal as well. In the spring of 1970, the Pompidou government, Pompidou had succeeded de Gaulle in 1969, made the mistake of, in a fit of paranoia, one might say, of impounding the proletarian left, Gauche Proletarian Journal, which was called, it's a Maoist expression, La Cause du Peuple, and imprisoning two of their leaders. There were probably 150, 200 people in all of Paris who were reading this newspaper on any kind of regular basis, but the Pompidou government managed to make celebrities out of them. Paris is a small milieu where there are only two or three degrees of separation between students and the most famous intellectuals, and sure enough, one of the students knew Jean-Paul Sartre, immediately had a meeting with him in his favorite cafe, La Coupole, Boulevard du Montparnasse, asked him if, in view of the imprisonment of the Maoist editors, Sartre would take over the and become titular editor of Maoist daily, La Cause du Peuple. Sartre actually ended up becoming titular editor of three Maoist organs. And once Sartre was involved, who was, needless to say, an intellectual and political actor who had world renown, there was no keeping the Maoists down, and also the support movement for the imprisoned Maoist leaders. They immediately became cause célèbre and kindled the imagination of almost all of France. It seemed like such a grotesque injustice. Obviously, there are very fundamental questions of civil liberties and freedom of the press, etc., at issue here. Many of these had been abrogated, which only reinforced the sense that the students and French youth had felt they were living under a dictatorship, and the government and the regime played right into their hands via these actions, repressive actions, with very little pretext.
So this upswelling of social movements that followed 68, as you say, the women's movement, gay liberation, and so on, were in many ways actually quite deeply connected to French Maoism. To what degree can these kinds of movements be understood as being connected to Maoist ideology? I mean, on the one hand, as you've mentioned, there was already this critique of everyday life, and one can think of Henri Lefebvre and other people who wrote about the particularities and politics of everyday life, of cities, and so on. Yet, Maoism seemed to add an additional impulse to it. So what dimension of that actually really came straight out of Maoism?
Well, that's an excellent question. And it bespeaks a process, I call it in the book, a process of grafting, or a process of unintended consequences, whereby ideas and a political ideology that had a very different meaning in China were translated into French circumstances with very different outcomes. To be a bit judgmental as I am in the book, in a Chinese context, the Cultural Revolution was very much a disaster, so much a disaster just in terms of the disruptions of political economic life in China that very shortly after, a couple of years after its launching, Mao had to call in Lin Piao and the People's Liberation Army to get the Red Guards, the radical students, back into the universities and out of Chinese public life, since it had been a total disruption. There were certain Maoist slogans that these French students, as I point out in the book, conversely, few could read Chinese. There were few accounts. During the Cultural Revolution, China was very much a closed society. Really, the first autobiographical accounts of people being sent down and persecutions perpetrated during Cultural Revolution really didn't filter out until the very late 60s or 1970, and then, of course, they'd have to be translated into Western language to be fully understood. So there were Maoist ideas, populist ideas, that jibed with French Rousseauianism, and ideas of direct democracy, ideas of going to the people, the mass line. And one slogan that I quote in the book, Maoist slogan, or saying by Mao himself, if one wants to smell the flowers, if one wants to smell the flower, one has to get off the horse. There are all these, in China, the party was still very much in control, with the exception of certain moments of the Cultural Revolution that precipitated chaos. In France, the Little Red Book was, very widely read. Mao was quoted all throughout the West by the Black Panthers, by German leftists. If I reread a couple months ago the Bader-Meinhof Manifesto, the urban guerrilla concept, and it's a very short document, about 15 pages, and there are about 20 quotations from Chairman Mao in the book. So these ideas really were quite rife at the time. But the French students translated these Maoist sayings and slogans in terms of the background they'd had in what one might call leftism, or the ultra-left, that is these far-left small groups, socialism and barbarism, Situationist International, etc., who were preaching the virtues of self-management, direct democracy, participatory democracy, etc., very anti-bureaucratic, anti-hierarchical, in keeping with the mood of the 60s and May 68. So there was a fascinating process of political misunderstanding. I call it a fruitful political misunderstanding or translation process, whereby ideas that were not very successful in their original context, that is Maoist China, were transposed to a French context and had very different positive outcomes in terms of these social movements that you just mentioned.
So, Richard Wolin, as you argue in The Wind from the East, the impact of French Maoism on French society and French intellectual life on the left in some ways can't be underestimated and yet is not well known. There's a fascinating story of the influence of Maoism on Jean-Paul Sartre at the end of his life. As you say, he had become an activist in some ways, a figurehead, allowing himself to be used by the Maoists when the state was banning their publications and so on. But perhaps the most interesting story of all is that of Michel Foucault, who had come out of what in many ways was a pretty apolitical background, was a structuralist philosopher, although I'm not sure if he identified entirely as such, but came out of this intellectual strand that saw structures as being determinant in the course of history rather than the agency of individuals. And yet he, who missed May 68, came back to France and was profoundly influenced by the Maoists, and it really shaped the ideas that I think we associate with his thought.
Yes, I think that Foucault really stands out for a number of reasons. Obviously, there are the obvious reasons, which is he wrote fascinating books from which one can still learn so much. He had a very visible presence in Berkeley, as one knows. But what's really outstanding about Foucault, from my perspective and from the perspective of the narrative of my book, The Wind from the East, is that he was really able to learn, unlike many of the other structuralists, such as Althusser, Levi-Strauss, Barthes, Roland Barthes, who was never really political. Anyway, Foucault was able to draw some very astute political conclusions about the breakthrough, the political breakthrough of May 68, that the structuralist framework, otherwise, as you aptly described it, that there were no longer events, événements in French, that history is frozen somehow. We have to concern ourselves with what Fernand Braudel, the structuralist historian, called the longue durée, that is the long march of time. Foucault was able to, despite the markedly structuralist orientation of certain of his books of the 60s, The Order of Things, probably the best known, he was able to understand how certain structuralist, for want of a better term, prejudices against events and against history and politics, which was kind of, you know, the superstructure or epiphenomenal, were outmoded. These prejudices were outmoded after 68. But this wasn't a traditional revolt or revolution. It wasn't the one, it didn't follow the logic that Marx had described, really, of class versus class. There were so many other issues pertaining to, as we've discussed, the critique of everyday life, that it called for new types of paradigms and analyses and methods to appreciate what had gone on and to understand how to go forward. And that's what's key about Foucault, is that here's, to me, this is a beautiful irony, is that late in 1970, I think it was December 1970, he was elected at the age of 46 to the Collège de France. And I'm sorry, he was 44. He was born in 1926. So the Collège de France, which is really the highest accolade, aside from the Académie Française, that a French intellectual can aspire to. And precisely at that time, Foucault dedicated himself for the next several years to a life of activism. He co-founded, two months later, in February 71, the Prison Informations Group, and for a year, his daily activities were, you know, solidly involved in supporting this group and leading this group. In fact, his apartment on Rue Vaugirard in Paris became the de facto headquarters of the group. And it's an interesting phenomenon because, above all, Foucault and his fellow prison information group leaders didn't want to fall into any outmoded authoritarian political traps. All they wanted to do was do, this is a Maoist phrase too, do enquête in French, or have investigations. Allow the prisoners, it was a very close, French prisons were an extremely closed milieu at the time. No one who wasn't a prisoner could really get in to see them or talk to prisoners at the time. But they constantly petitioned, they talked to relatives of the prisoners, tried to get information, tried to communicate, and wrote to the prisoners, and began publishing a newsletter where the prison, in terms of this Maoist notion of the mass line or going to the people, believing that the people, not the party, had the authentic voice. And this stimulated a great debate in France about the fate of prisons, and now you can see how the whole phenomenon of the microphysics of power and the whole notion of micropowers with which Foucault's later work is associated, above all in Discipline and Punish, which appeared in 75, was really, in my interpretation, based or generated out of his experiences as an activist for the prison information group. This is how he understood power in a non-Marxist way, not in the logic of the factory. The factory is no longer the locus of domination, but power operates at the, you might say, the corpuscular level. It suffuses society in so many ways, shapes, manners, or forms, and this really opened up totally new vistas on how power functions in society that is not focused on the state, is not focused on the wage, labor, capital dyad per se, but in a much more pluralistic fashion that's consistent with some of the orientations of the 60s and May 68, et cetera. So Foucault has this incredible intellectual mental flexibility for a professor, it's unusual, I think I can say that, to change with the times and to learn from these experiences in a way that few others did.
Well, I'm afraid this hour has just flown by, so I guess I want to end by asking you the difficult question, which is, how do you assess the legacy of French Maoism? Why does this history matter today in any way?
I think that, you know, the German leader of the SDS, Rudi Dutschke, coined in the early 70s the phrase, actually, he borrowed it from Chairman Mao, the long march to the institutions. Of course, with Mao, it was the long march. Dutschke talked about the long march to the institutions. And in many respects, there was a parallel process in France whereby many of these Maoist, former Maoist activists became involved either in the French Socialist Party or other grassroots groups or organizations. I've already alluded to French feminism, French gay rights, etc., and really transformed the nature of French civil society and the nature of French associational life. There were so many prejudices against the traditional statist model of French politics, going back to, you know, Louis XIV, the Sun King, Napoleon, de Gaulle, etc., that politics in the you know, statist sense or top-down sense had become a dirty word, and thus society became a new locus of struggle and contestation. One can attribute this kind of breakthrough only to the Maoists, because it was a more generalized phenomenon in the early 70s. But this is certainly one of the legacies of Maoist activism, the ability to de-dogmatize themselves, de-ideologize themselves, and translate their concerns for emancipation to other kinds of social struggles that really revitalized French civil society in many significant ways.
My guest has been Richard Wolin. He is an intellectual historian. He teaches history at the CUNY Graduate Center and is the author of a number of books, including The Frankfurt School Revisited and Other Essays on Politics and Society and The Seduction of Unreason, The Intellectual Romance with Fascism from Nietzsche to Postmodernism. And he's the author of The Wind from the East, which we've been discussing today, May 68, French Intellectuals and the Chinese Cultural Revolution. It's published by Princeton University Press, and we have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Richard, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me, Sasha.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, and it's the most reliable way to sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, or visit us on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. I'd like to thank our engineer today, Erica Bridgman.